hppodcraft.com.
After dinner, men came with ropes to tie up Dr. Pangloss and his disciple Candide, one for talking and the other for listening with an air of approval. Both were taken separately to a set of remarkably cool apartments where the glare of the sun is never bothersome. 8 days later, they were both dressed in sanbenitos and crowned with paper mitres. Wearing these costumes, they marched in a procession and listened to a very touching sermon, followed by a beautiful concert of plain song. Candide was flogged in cadence to the music, and Pangloss was hanged, though hanging is not customary. On the same day, there was another earthquake, causing frightful damage. Candide, stunned, stupefied, despairing, bleeding, trembling, said to himself, "If this is the best of all possible worlds, what are the others like?"
Another solid joke from Candide by Voltaire. We're in part two of this book here at hppodcraft.com, Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We are joined once again by Levi Nunez of the band Loot the Body. Yes. You're hearing that right now. It's going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I was a fool not to play it last time. You are hearing the song Layers of Your Mind right now, which I really dig. Of course, I'm talking over it, so do yourself a favor and get over to the Loot the Body YouTube page and listen to it without us talking, as well as without prejudice. Listen with neither us speaking nor prejudice, and you will really enjoy it. That's my promise to you. Thanks, Levi, for reading. Let's do a quick recap.
Where we left off, Candide, a young man raised as nobility, is cast out of his home for kissing his love, Cunegonde. He was left in the street starving, pressed into military service, escaped, got a job in a rug factory, found his old mentor devastated by syphilis, got him cured, found out his family was all killed except for Cunegonde, who was then raped, then gutted. But then he went on a business trip to Lisbon, got shipwrecked, swam to Lisbon, discovered Lisbon was just hit by an earthquake, tried to help people, got accused of heresy, and is now, with his mentor, going to be burned at the stake.
So pretty standard setup.
Yeah.
You know, give the hero some relatable problems. But as in real life, at that time, an auto da fé is performed to ward off another earthquake. That happened after the Lisbon earthquake. A bunch of people are taken to this auto da fé to be killed for totally arbitrary offenses, all of which are described as arbitrarily as possible. And Candide has to watch Pangloss be hanged in front of him. Yes. And then, of course, another earthquake strikes, as we heard at the end there. So all of this was pointless. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. And Candide, at this point, actually expresses some empathy for the first time because... You know, he was flogged as part of this auto da fé, but he thinks, well, it's not so bad. I've been flogged before. Why did I have to watch Pangloss be hanged right in front of me? How is that possibly for the best?
Well, in all the commotion of the new earthquake, an old woman shows up and takes Candide away. And that gets us into chapter 7, how an old woman took Candide and how he regained what he loved. This old woman takes Candide, cleans his wounds, feeds him, and gives him some new clothes.
Yeah, one of my favorite chapters... It's really just a suspense chapter in that, who is this? What's this mystery? But he's taken to this shanty, and it just sounds really nice. She says, just chill, I'll bring you breakfast, lie around and get better. And I think maybe Voltaire's cutting the reader a little break here, too.
Yeah.
Quick ointment break, guys. You know, the first act's been kind of rough. Maybe a little good news to keep you hooked into the book.
Now, when he's well enough, the old woman takes him out to the country to meet his secret benefactor, and it's Cunegonde! But how can she be alive?
He says... Then you were never raped? You never had your belly ripped open? Oh, yes, Cunegonde says, but one doesn't always die of these two accidents. It's just so frank and hilarious. And it's that thing, at first you hope that this was all misinformation, but no, it's just Candide where everybody gets three lives. You know, no, all that happened, but I survived it somehow. The video game logic in this thing.
That gets us into chapter 8, Cunegonde's story. She explains that her family was killed by the Bulgars and that she, after seeing her family killed, fainted. So seeing her faint gave this 6-foot-tall Bulgar the idea to rape her. She woke up and tried to fight him off, but was stabbed in the thigh.
When you're saying Cunegonde, did you look up that that's how to pronounce it?
Yes.
When I'm saying Cunegonde, and I think that, you know, Levi did in our readings as well, it's just how I always read it. That's her name in my mind. And Cunegonde says that she fought because she wasn't aware that being raped was a matter of routine in the world. She goes, oh, I figured it out later that this is just what happens to women. And it's pretty awful.
Oh.
One might be tempted to say all this rape and murder shouldn't be played for laughs. I don't think it is. It's like the laughs aren't coming at the expense of the victims. You laugh because there's this bleak truth in it.
Yes.
It's also funny at this point when she says, I got stabbed in the thigh. I still have the scar on my left thigh. And Candide immediately says, what a pity. I should very much like to see it. So it's like he's learning empathy, but he's not totally on that empathy trip yet. You know, he's still a little lustful.
So the captain of the Bulgars saw this rape, and since the rapist didn't stand to attention when he arrived, the captain had him killed. The captain had her wound tended to and gave her a washing job as a prisoner of war, but he then thought that she was beautiful.
Yeah, she says, I confess it. He was a handsome fellow, even though he was stupid.
After 3 months, this guy got bored with her, traded her to a man named Don Isaacer, a Jew. Now, he has been trying to have sex with her, but she's been able to keep him at bay.
She says, for though a person of honor may be raped once, her virtue is only strengthened by the experience, which threatens to almost be rape me once, shame on you, rape me twice. You know, that's almost what the joke is. And again, the humor isn't about the act of violence. If you laugh, it's because the world is so terrible that somebody would even come around to that opinion.
Yeah.
So, you know, with Don, she uses her sexuality to gain some control over the situation. That's the lesson that she learned.
This cottage that she's at now is his. But after seeing her at Mass, the Grand Inquisitor was taken by her beauty and wanted her for himself. Now, Don refused, but after being threatened with a burning at the stake, they arranged a timeshare of Kunigunde.
Yeah, they each assigned a couple of days a week, although there's some confusion over who gets to be with her on Saturday night going into Sunday. There's probably something specific that he's satirizing. But for me, in general, I thought it was how difficult it is for religions to coexist and how it's almost kind of absurd because we do need to have this tolerance. But these religions do spell out a pretty sad fate for the people who don't believe in them. Mm-hmm. And that inherent conflict is kind of weird. But the Grand Inquisitor, he set up this auto de fe to prevent another earthquake, as we said. But we find out it was also to freak out Don with his Inquisition powers to show that this is what he can do to him and to impress Kunigunde, who he brought along to watch it.
She saw Pangloss and Candide being whipped before they were to be burned and wanted to save them.
And now you said she obviously still loves Candide, but this is what she says. She goes, and as I saw you stripped for the lash, I may tell you, by the way, that your skin is even whiter and more delicate than that of my Bulgar captain. You know, one might suspect that if Candide wasn't keeping it tight, this reunion might not have happened. She's mentioned how good looking these men are so far that have been kidnapping her. So she's a little lascivious, just like Candide was when he wanted to see the scar on her thigh.
She sent the old woman to rescue him and bring him to the house. Just then, Don Isaacer shows up, and that gets us into chapter 9. What happened to Kunigunde, Candide, the Grand Inquisitor, and the Jew? Of course, he's angry that Candide is there, thinking that he wants in on this Kunigunde share. So he attacks Candide with a dagger, but the old woman gave Candide a sword. He surprises the Don with the sword and runs him through. Kind of almost accidentally kills him just because the guy came at him and he just defended himself. And just then the Grand Inquisitor arrives, finds the murdered man, and Candide panics and kills him as well. Kunigunde grabs all of her jewels and they take 3 horses and flee with the old woman, who explains she could only ride with 1 buttock. They flee to Cadiz.
Yeah, this whole scene produces what I think might be my favorite line in the book. I still have the last quarter to read, but Candide kills the second holy man and Kunigunde asks, how is it that you, who were born so gentle, could kill in 2 minutes a Jew and a prelate? My dear girl, replied Candide, when a man is in love, jealous, and just whipped by the Inquisition, he is no longer himself. That made me laugh so hard. He really uses the rule of threes there, too. Because we've all been in love, we've all been jealous, but then whipped by the Inquisition, as if that's something that everybody can relate to. Yeah, yeah, that's true. When I was just whipped by the Inquisition, I was a different person for a while there.
When the Holy Brotherhood finds the Inquisitor, they give him a grand funeral, but of course they just throw Don Isaacer's body onto a dunghill.
Obviously meant to show, again, the arbitrary and cruel nature of religion and intolerance.
They end up in a small town at an inn, and that gets us into chapter 10. In deep distress, Candide, Kunigunde, and the old woman reach Cadiz. They put to sea.
Voltaire jumps ahead a bit after the escape, and we find them in mid-conversation.
Turns out a Franciscan friar steals Kunigunde's jewels. Candide is reminded of Pangloss's teaching, the fruits of the earth are common heritage of all, but it doesn't make him feel any better about being broke.
He wonders, you know, if he stole from us, we all have a common heritage. He couldn't have left a little behind. Candide at this point still thinks that everybody got the same instruction as him. Why didn't that thief understand the common heritage thing?
So they sell one of the horses, and it makes it harder for the old woman since she can only ride with 1 buttock.
This is something that she drops into conversation frequently without further elaboration, which is funny in and of itself. But, you know, you guys will just have to be patient with me. I've just got the 1 buttock. Why does she keep mentioning it?
They make it to Cadiz, where they find some troops preparing to sail for the New World. It seems Paraguayan Jesuit priests have caused a native tribe to rebel against the kings of Spain and Portugal. Candide shows his military experience to the general, and he is made a captain. Candide takes Cunegonde, the old woman, and the horses with him on the boat and predicts that the New World will be the best of all possible worlds.
Right. They're headed to the Americas. Now, there's a lot of philosophy conversation on their trip. They end up thinking, well, maybe the New World is going to be the good one. But Candide first asserts, he says, we are destined in the end for another universe. No doubt that is the one where everything is well. For in this one, it must be admitted, there is some reason to grieve over our physical and moral state. And, you know, I just thought, this is sort of how it works, isn't it? People, you know, it seems like, oh, everything's for purpose, everything's for the good. And then you get enough of life and you go, they must be talking about an afterlife or something. This must be all suffering, and then that's going to be great. You have to almost make up a fictional planet for it to make any sense at all.
Cunegonde, having suffered as much as she has lost faith in the teachings of Pangloss. The old woman says, you have no reason to be down. You had it easy. Cunegonde's like, what are you talking about? No one has had it as bad as me.
And she pulls a turn of the screw. She says, hey, unless you've had two disembowelings, seen two of your castles destroyed, watched two of your mothers murdered, unless you went through two turns of the screw, you can't possibly have had it as bad as me.
And the old woman says, hold my beer. And that gets us into chapter 11, the old woman's story. She explains that she was one of the daughters of Pope Urban X. Did popes have kids?
Well, Pope Urban did. He was the hip, edgy, streetwise pope that they tried to introduce. You know, when the church was losing audience. He was the Poochie of Catholicism.
Pope Urban. See, yes.
Had kids, rode a skateboard, lived in a cool attic room in the Vatican. He wrote the famous sermon, Pope Urban Gonna Bang Ya, featuring Little Bishop. Everybody's heard that.
So this old woman is not only the Pope's daughter, but she is the Princess of Palestrina. She lived in splendor that would put the German castles to shame.
Ugh, I hate this old woman and her hyperbole. I think Cunegonde was on the right track, you know, that this woman maybe hasn't had as bad a life as her. It's hard to know, but when she's talking, sure. She says stuff like, everybody in Italy wrote poems about my beauty and they still fell short, you know. The women who helped dress and undress her fell into ecstasies, whether they looked at me from in front or behind. I think to strengthen the loss of that one buttock was a real loss. This was a perfect set of buttocks.
Crying shame. 14 years old, and she's already a stunning beauty. She was engaged to the Prince of Massa-Carrara, and they were in love. So it wasn't just an arranged thing. She was in love with this guy. However, after their over-the-top wedding, the prince's mistress poisoned him, and he died.
Yeah, I don't even know if they got to the wedding. The planning was over the top, but that mistress, she wasn't going to let this happen. That was how the poisoning went down.
So the old woman, then young, went with her mother to their estate in Gaeta. Unfortunately, on the day that they left, they were attacked by pirates. The Pope's soldiers, of course, they didn't even fight the pirates. They're just like, okay, sure, whatever.
Defending themselves as papal troops usually do, is what it says. And that's kind of a Clark Ashton Smith burn on the church there.
The pirates searched every orifice of everyone on board looking for hidden jewels.
Yeah, sort of a prostate check on everybody. And then again, there's a joke where she says, I was kind of surprised by this when they were investigating our keisters, but then somebody explained, no, this is just how it works. Very common practice. And so, you know, it wasn't a big deal after that.
So all the women were raped and then taken as slaves to be sold in Morocco. Well, there was a civil war going on in Morocco and the pirates were attacked. The young woman saw her mother and her maids ripped apart by men fighting over them.
They grab a limb, they pull in all different directions. They literally rip her apart.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's trying to say here, but it was kind of interesting how Cunegonde's time is divided up by the Jew and the Grand Inquisitor. And then here in Africa, they are physically ripped apart. Women are just cut up and divided in all of these different ways, constantly.
Yeah. At the end of this bloody fight, she crawled out from under all the bodies and rested under a tree. When she woke up, she found an Italian eunuch poorly attempting to rape her. He says in Italian, oh, what misfortune, I have no testicles. And that gets us into chapter 11, the old woman's story continued.
In his mind, he's experiencing misfortune.
Yeah.
He's like, I cannot believe the perfect victim is here, and I can't do it.
So the young old woman was pleased to hear her native tongue again, because he is Italian, and she found this man attractive. So she told him of what had befallen her, and he took her to a nearby house, and he took care of her, and he flattered her, and he told her that she was the most beautiful. He's a eunuch because they cut off his testicles so he would sing better. It says they canonize 2,000 or 3,000 children every year. Some die of it. Others acquire a voice more beautiful than any woman. Still, others go on to become governors of kingdoms. And I thought, that's pretty weird. Turns out it was a reference to Castrato Farinelli, who became powerful politically under 2 kings of Spain. So this eunuch had served under the old woman's mother at her palace, and he promised to take her back there.
It's one of those chance meetings where he goes, I actually served as the eunuch singer in your palace when you were young. And it seems like he's going to be a good guy. He says, I'm going to bring you back to Italy. She goes, I thanked him with tears of gratitude. And instead of returning me to Italy, he took me to Algiers and sold me. So, nope.
The young old woman was sold many times over and ended up with a Muslim military commander. They were then attacked and trapped in a fort by the Russians. Now, during the siege, they ran out of supplies and they had to eat the eunuchs. Still hungry, they were going to eat the women, but a pious and sympathetic religious leader convinced them to eat only one buttock. And that's what it was all about.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Because if they were still hungry, they could always eat the other buttock later.
Yeah.
But before they could eat the second buttock, the Russians broke the defenses and that was over.
I believe that if that's called a badanka. Voltaire clearly really found this so funny. I actually think the one buttock is foreshadowed more than any other single thing in the book. But it's so juvenile, and he was treasuring it so much. That in and of itself makes me laugh.
So the women were taken to Moscow, where a nobleman took the old woman as a slave. He beat her every day for 2 years. He was then executed for court intrigue, and the old woman was able to escape. Now, this is probably a reference to the conspiracy against Peter the Great, known as the Revolt of Strelitz. She worked as a servant in inns across Russia. She came close to suicide many times, but she never went through with it.
100 times I wanted to kill myself, but always I loved life more. This ridiculous weakness is perhaps one of our worst instincts. Is anything more stupid than choosing to carry a burden that really one wants to cast on the ground? To hold existence in horror and yet to cling to it. To fondle the serpent which devours us till it has eaten out our heart.
You know, I think that's in specific reference to a philosopher who advocated suicide. In the footnotes, it was pointed out that this was somebody who did it themselves when they were 67.
Right? Oh, right.
So
yes.
It was like,
yes.
They were like, everybody should commit suicide, but, you know, I'm going to wait a while before I do mine. It's a bleak way to look at things.
Yes. Well, I mean, this woman, she loved life too much, so she continued on with it. She tells Candide and Cunegonde to ask each passenger on the ship to tell them their stories. She wagers, if you find a single one who has not often cursed the day of his birth, who has not often told himself that he is the most miserable of men, then you may throw me overboard head first.
Thyclops was also something I thought of for one. Just want to say that one. Before we get out of this chapter.
That was a good one. That gets us into chapter 13, how Candide was forced to leave the lovely Cunegonde and the old woman. Taking the old woman up on this wager, they ask everybody on the ship about their lives, and the old woman was totally right. Everyone hates their lives. The ship docks in Buenos Aires, and they go to the governor, Don Fernando de Ibarra y Figuera y Macerata y Labrava y Labrava.
He's got a lot of names.
And he's got a great mustache.
You know, this is just like in the very first chapter where he said the baroness who ran the castle was very, very fat. And that's why she got so much respect. He always says, you know, some other thing aside from they do good works. This guy's got a lot of names and a great mustache. So clearly they put him in charge.
He orders Candide to check on his men. And when Candide does, Don Fernando begs Cunegonde to marry him. The old woman says to Cunegonde, takes her to the side and says, you should marry this guy. Candide doesn't have anything, and this guy will make you rich, and you can still keep Candide around and make him rich as well, you know, keep him as a little side thing. Unfortunately for Candide, the Portuguese police arrive with an official who chased Candide to Buenos Aires for killing the Grand Inquisitor.
Their crime caught up with them here.
It turns out the Franciscan friar who stole the jewels from them, tried to sell them, he got caught and told the authorities where he stole them from, and then that Franciscan was hung, you know. He didn't really get anything out of it besides.
Yeah.
Candide, Cunegonde, and the old woman are all wanted for the crimes, but the old woman argues that it was Candide who did the murdering, and the governor agrees that they're not really at fault, the old woman and Cunegonde. So during this debate, the old woman tells Candide just to get the hell out of there.
She's opportunistic. This is a good deal for her girl, and she kind of exploits. I think she wants to get rid of Candide. you know? So she says, you better get out of here, buddy. Yeah. It, he does need to get out of there, but
he does.
I think she's happy about it.
Chapter 14, how Candide and Cacambo were received by the Jesuits in Paraguay. Candide is able to pick up this valet, Cacambo.
Yeah, it seems like maybe Cacambo's been a servant for a while at this point. They know each other very well, and he's just now mentioned in the book. But it's that kind of squire with a clear-eyed view of the world. You see that character a lot.
This guy told Candide to take the old woman's advice because he actually likes Candide. He tells Candide not to worry about Cunegunde because God always takes care of women.
Clearly.
I then suggest that they go to the rebel Paraguayan Jesuits. The two go to that camp, but their horses and weapons are seized. And Candide says he wants to talk to the colonel, but the sergeant says that the Father Provincial hates Spaniards. And Cacambo explains that Candide is German. And that's cool. So he's like, oh, he's German. Come on in.
Yeah. You know, Cacambo knows who hates who. And that actually turns out to be the best skill you can have in this book. Because he uses it multiple times to get them out of trouble.
He does. So the colonel has a lavish pavilion. He orders the horses and weapons returned, and it turns out that the colonel is actually Cunegunde's brother, the now Baron of Thunder Tentroc. Candide reports that Cunegunde is alive and that she is with the governor. While they wait for the Father Provincial, the colonel tells his story.
It's very interesting how perspectives are being revealed throughout this section of the book. We hear other people's backstories, but just that there where Cacambo says, you know, God always takes care of women. It's clear he's never really considered the reality of a woman's life. But nobody's imagining the reality of anybody's life. And that basic level of self-centeredness, I think, shows how it's really impossible for anybody to solve any of these problems because nobody's thinking about what do people go through as a result of what I'm doing. It's just not even a thought that anybody has even once. And I feel like this section is really underscoring that.
Yeah. And that gets us into chapter 15, how Candide killed the brother of his dear Cunegunde. He does such a great job with these chapter titles.
Oh, yeah. They're so funny.
He explains that the Bulgars attacked the castle. The colonel was left because they thought he was dead. He was thrown onto a cart of corpses and taken to a Jesuit chapel for burial. A Jesuit sprinkled holy water on his eyes and saw that he was alive. So he took him in and nursed him to health. And after 3 weeks, he recovered completely.
Is this Neosporin that's doing all this stuff? I gotta get this ointment.
I know. Syphilis is just like, bam. He explains he was a very pretty boy and had a very tender friendship with a higher up in the church. He was then sent to Rome and became a Jesuit himself. He was sent to Paraguay, where he became a colonel and a priest.
So he's basically used his sexuality, just like his sister, to get what he can out of the world.
The colonel plans to bring Cunegunde to Paraguay, and Candide says, that's great because we plan to get married. And this infuriates the colonel because Candide is not nobility. Candide points out that Pangloss said that all men are created equal, and that he has done so much for Cunegunde that she wants to actually marry Candide. But the colonel slaps Candide with his sword, and Candide then stabs him in the gut. And after he does it, Candide just cries. Cacambo has a plan, and he dresses up Candide in the colonel's Jesuit cassock, and then they flee.
The idea that it really doesn't matter what you've done with your life, you'll always be lesser, so you can't marry her, even though you rescued her or saved her or, you know, it just, your worth is all predetermined. Ugh. So that's just a funny turn of events. He goes, marry my sister, what? And then they takes such a quick turn after the superlatives about how much they're hugging each other and loving each other and so grateful to see each other. I was wondering, because Cacambo again goes, you got to disguise yourself and we got to get the F out of here when Candide was ready to give up. Why do you think Candide almost never rescues himself?
Well, I mean, he got himself out of the situation with the Bulgars.
Did he? I mean, he walked away, but I don't think he necessarily knew. I mean, he just kind of walks one circumstance into the next in a very passive way.
Yes.
Maybe that's something we can talk about a little in the next episode. But I was like, why do we have a character who makes really no active choices? And when he gets out of trouble, it's the servants. It's the servant who does the rescue.
The servants are the ones that motivate everything. The old woman before, she was the one that was motivating all their, get the hell out of their stuff. And yeah, you're right.
The main characters are very controlled by the people helping them.
Well, that gets us into chapter 16, one of my favorite chapters. What happened to the two travelers with two girls, two monkeys, and the savages named Big Lugs? Candide and Cacambo end up in a strange country with no roads. They see two naked women running in a meadow, pursued by two monkeys biting at their legs. Candide thinks rescuing these women, hey, that's going to get me in the good graces of these people that live here, the locals, if I'm going to save them. So he pulls out his gun and he shoots the monkeys.
His mouth shut suddenly when he saw the girls embracing the monkeys tenderly, weeping over their bodies and filling the air with lamentations. I wasn't looking for quite so much generosity of spirit, said he to Cacambo. The latter replied, "You've really fixed things this time, Master. You've killed the two lovers of these young ladies."
"They're lovers? Impossible! You must be joking, Kakambo. How can I believe you?"
"My dear Master," Kakambo replied, "you're always astonished by everything. Why do you think it's so strange that in some countries monkeys succeeded in obtaining the good graces of women? They are one quarter human, just as I am one quarter Spanish."
I laughed out loud once again. I forgot about that, and it's a really funny turn of events. If you believe their takeaway that the monkeys were their lovers, it's just such a funny misunderstanding. Got them! And then the women immediately, "No!" crying is so funny. But then it's also funny if they don't understand what the women are saying and make that assumption. Because maybe they're just, maybe they really are kind and just didn't want the animals to be hurt.
Right. Maybe they could have been their pets.
Combo's like, "No, they're lovers." And Candide goes, "You know, I have heard about centaurs and things like that, so it actually does make sense."
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah, Kakambo's like, they're one quarter human, just like I'm one quarter Spanish.
I mean, that's true. I just watched a show last night about people dancing with dogs, and it was going really well, so. Who are we to judge?
They beat feed out of there and eventually find a place to sleep and they lay down. But when they wake up, they are themselves prisoners of the Big Lugs.
Kind of an Ewok situation. They tied up the whole thing.
Yes. The Big Lugs are stoked that they get to kill some Jesuits and then they get to eat them. So Kakambo fortunately knows their language. He explains to them that Candide is not a Jesuit, but in fact, he just killed a Jesuit and stole their clothes. He tells them to take the clothes back to the border and ask the guards there at the border if those actually belong, if he did kill this Jesuit guy. And for some reason, they agree to this. So they take the clothes, they leave, confirm the story, and come back. And then they show Candide and Kakambo honors and hospitality for a while. So they show them a really good time, and then they escort them to the edge of their land.
Yeah, the bureaucracy of the Big Lugs works better than any of the European powers. They actually go check out their story to make sure they're not doing the wrong thing. Whereas before, they've been, whipped, burned, they might have been mistaken for something. It didn't matter at all. The Big Lugs are much more thorough about this, which is great. And again, Kakambo knows they hate Jesuits. He uses hate and division to his personal advantage. He's got the right idea in this world.
And at this point, Candide confirms that this is the best of all possible worlds. And I think that is a good place to stop.
It is a good place to stop because it's a happy ending at this point. Yeah. It's that idea that it is the best of all possible worlds. Maybe that day you can keep coming around to that conclusion. You know what? If all those awful things didn't happen to me, then I wouldn't be here. That may be true, but was it terrible to go through all those awful things? I just don't. This confusion of cause and effect that, because there's an effect, that all the causes were justified. That's what the whole book's attacking, and every time it comes up short. But we did it. We got through these chapters, and there's more to do in the next two episodes, but it's such an enjoyable book. I want to thank our reader, Levi Nunez, for taking the journey with us.
Levi, you're so amazing, and Levi's music, Loot the Body, is fantabulous, so please go check it out. You will not be sorry.
Yeah, you're hearing some of it now, and we'll play a little on our way out. I want to thank some patrons as we are on our way out, and I want to start by thanking James Dunn.
I'd like to thank Heather W.
I'd like to thank Mike Mikos.
I'd like to thank Nicholas Medovinovic.
I'd like to thank Philip Cowan.
Lewis Shaw, thank you.
Daniel L. Felton, thank you.
I'd like to thank Maltese Samurai.
Juan Negruela, thank you.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Alan R.C. Raventree.
Woo, that's a cool name. Thanks, Alan.
That's a great name.
Thank you all. We're going to be coming back at you with Candide. And until that time, I've been Chad Pfeiffer.
And I am still Chris Lackey.
And you're listening to HBPodcraft.com. I'm on fire, see.